First and Second Chronicles. Now, it seems, as you look on the surface, that First and Second Chronicles repeat or highlight much of what is in First and Second Samuels and First and Second Kings, but it's much broader than that. We know from let me read a few verses here by way of introduction. Chapter 6, verse 15, talks about Jehozadak went into captivity when the Lord carried away Judah and Jerusalem by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. So we know the author is writing post-exile, again in chapter 9, verse 1, and you'll find other places. So all Israel were reckoned by genealogies, and behold, they were written in the book of the kings of Israel and of Judah, who were carried away to Babylon for their transgression. So the writer is writing post-exile. As we begin to step into this, then realize that these nine chapters of genealogy are 3,500 years of Israel's history being handed to a generation that will come back from the captivity of Babylon without a king. There's no longer a king in Israel. Ezra will come back to rebuild the temple. Nehemiah to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. But Israel will see no king like she did from the time of Saul and David onward to the captivity. And yet Israel has to maintain her identity, the tribes, their heritage. The messianic promise would still be alive when the nation was brought back from captivity. So these chapters that may seem very mundane to us contain the legacy and the heritage and the history of a people coming back from the captivity. The Talmud tells us that Ezra is the author of 1st and 2nd Chronicles. We have no biblical evidence one way or another, and that traditionally is as valid as anything put forth. It does seem that Ezra would be the author, and he gives us, rather than just a chronological history of the nation like 1st and 2nd Samuels and 1st and 2nd Kings, he gives us a theological history. And we'll see that as we move through in regards to what he makes a point of and what he omits. This author is quick to take us to the line of David and to the kings of Israel, to the line of Levi and Aaron, and to the temple. And those are the things that this author wants to trace out in front of us to give us this record that was so important to the nation of Israel. We'll move quickly from Adam to Noah to Abraham to Judah to David and so on. It begins quickly, straightforwardly, Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel. You're thinking, I hope he's not going to do this for nine chapters. No, I'll warn you now so you don't get real depressed and I lose you right in the beginning. We're going to highlight, okay? So we're going to move. You don't have to worry about this. And I think you should read it on your own. It'd be really good for you, but we'll just highlight tonight. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, it's 1,000 years, did that fast, Shem, Ham, Japheth. We cover from Adam to the flood very quickly. Now, for your own inquisitive minds, if you haven't heard Chuck Missler when he's here, go over this genealogy, and I'll go over it. And you can do most of this with a strong concordance if you take the time. One of the names it's hard to track down. But realize as we go through this book that I'm sure there's certainly more contained than what we see on the surface. Adam, we know, means man. Cain killed Abel, and when Eve had another son, she named him Seth and said, God hath appointed me a son. So they named him Seth, which means appointed. Enosh, you look up in your Strong's Concordance, means mortal. Kenan is more difficult. It seems to, and I kind of struggle with it and look in a lot of different places. It means a position. It can mean a nest, a possession. It means to be fixed. It can be placed in that sense. A little hard. Mahalil, we know what hallelujah means, praise the Lord. Mahalil has the idea of blessing the Lord that is blessed. Jared means to descend, to come down. Enoch is to initiate, to instruct, to teach. Methuselah, if you remember, Methuselah is Enoch's son, and God told Enoch that when he dies, the flood will come. Therefore, he named him Methuselah. It means his death shall bring, or when he dies, it shall come. Lamech means sorrow or affliction. And Noah means comfort. So if we read the names in regards to their meanings without a break, it's man is appointed a mortal position, but the blessed God will come down teaching that his death shall bring the afflicted comfort. And you want to do that for the rest of the 9 chapters, welcome to it. That's as far as I'm going to go with it. But the idea is no ancient rabbi would hide the gospel in the first genealogy in the book of the Bible. You know, there's wonderful things here, no doubt, that are hidden. I think the point of the writer, particularly if it's Ezra, taking us on a theological journey through these people to preserve the Messianic line and the promise to Israel. When we come to Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, we first look at Japheth. Now, you'll find these things in the Table of Nations in Genesis chapter 10. If you look there on your own, and you can get a Bible handbook, one of those things, and it'll trace most of the names and tell you what people they're the progenitors of. Dr. William F. Albright, who is not a believer, but a world-renowned archaeologist when he was alive and considered the greatest expert in Middle Ancient Mideast history, said that the Table of Nations in Genesis chapter 10 is unsurpassed as a document tracking ancient peoples. And we have some of their names here. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, which was a broad, probably part of the Germanic tribes, Magog, which is the Scythians, Medea, Javan, we know as the Greeks, Tubal, Tobolsk, Meshech, Moscow, Togarma, down in verse 6, the house of Armenia, the house of Togarma, Armenia, parts of Turkey today, still relate to themselves as the house of Togarma. If you turn over to verse 8, we come to the sons of Ham. My kids love the story when they were little of Shem, Ham, and Japheth because they couldn't believe somebody in the Bible was named Ham. It would be like, was like being named bologna or corned beef to them. The sons of Ham, first Cush, it's Ethiopia. Mitzrayim is Egypt. That's important because as we go through this, I'm only going to mention this because today in the news, and certainly with a new administration coming in Washington, it was wonderful to hear Colin Powell speak yesterday. My heart was moved and touched. I think he's a great man. I'm curious to see who will be Secretary of Defense. I think Condoleezza Rice is a brilliant woman. Very strong administration, cabinet. But we face difficult times in the Middle East. And I think it's important to have strength. But as we look at the news and we talk about the Middle East, we talk about the Arab world. And in the mind of any Westerner watching TV, the Arab world is Egypt and Syria and Turkey and Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. No doubt we put that all in one category. But it's very interesting. That's not true at all. Here we have Mitzrayim in verse 8, one of the sons of Ham. That's Egypt. That's not Arab at all. If you go to Egypt and you ask them if they're Arab, no, they're Egyptians. They're not Arab. Put is Libya today. Now, by the way, what does sew all of those nations together is Islam. Islam is the common thread that runs through Iran, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Jordan, Egypt, Libya, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain. It's Islam that weaves them together. Down in verse 9 here, we have Sheba and Dedan, which I think identify the national locations, because the tribes themselves will be identified over verse 32, but they're the progenitors of Saudi Arabia. Cush begat Nimrod, verse 10. He became a mighty hunter upon the earth. Nimrod, the founder of Babel, ancient Babel, much earlier than Babylon, and much of the ancient mystery religion of Babel coming out of that initial founding of Babel. Down to verse 17. These are the sons of Shem. Now you want to take note of this, because Shem is the father of Eber, who's the father of the Hebrews. The interesting thing about that, of course, is the sons of Shem are Elam. Elam is the ancient name for Iran. Take note that the Israelite and the Iranian has the same blood flowing in his veins. Asher, the Assyrians. Interesting to read through some of these. Down in verse 18, we have Eber, which becomes the Haburai, which was a name given to a nomadic shepherds, which becomes Haburai. We derive Hebrew from that ultimately. Verse 19 says, "And unto Eber were born two sons, and the name of one was Peleg, because in his days the earth was divided." His brother's name was Joktan. "In his days the earth was divided." We hear much from our geologists about the continental drift, that they believe that South America and Africa and the United States and Europe at one point were one landmass. They were joined, and by the shape of those continents, they believe they can see how they were joined. So they believe that thousands and thousands of years ago, there was a great cataclysm. Something took place. There was a continental drift, a shifting of the continents. Now, that's interesting, because it says here, in the days of one of Noah's grandsons, Peleg, he was named Peleg, which means to divide, because in his day the earth was divided. That would explain some interesting things, because we have 270 ancient records around the world in different civilizations that write about a worldwide flood. It's no secret. 270 ancient records that archaeologists have uncovered that talk about a worldwide flood. Now, you find it in Inca records, you find it in Egypt, you find it all over the world. And the interesting thing is, you have the Tower of Babel, and then you have God dispersing, that was Nimrod in his day, dispersing the people by confounding their languages, and then God took it one step further and divided the continents. But you have this record of the flood going all around the world then, in all of these different cultures and civilizations. It says that those things took place in the days of Peleg, the son of Eber, when the earth was divided. Down to verse 24, we come to Shem, Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Sirig, Nahor, Terah, to Abram. That's where this, the one who's giving us this chronicle is headed, is to Abram. We're going to begin the the record of God's covenant with Abraham and this theological line, because ultimately the lesson in Chronicles is that a nation and a people that submit to God and to His ordinances, to His commandments, that there's blessing, and then that rebellion and idolatry lead to a distinct position apart from that, which is being away from God's blessing and His certainly under His discipline. The sons of Abraham, verse 28, are Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael born of Hagar. These are the generations. The firstborn of Ishmael, and I'm not going to try to read that, Nebaioth. Now Kedar, which is the ancient forefather of Kuwait, the city today. This is one of Abraham's son, the same blood in his veins as in the blood of, in the vein of a Jew. You have Kedar there. Look down in verse 32. You have the sons of Keturah. Keturah is Abraham's second wife. Married her when he was 145. That's because when he was 100, you remember the story, God said, you're going to have a son. And Sarah, when she heard that, she was 90. Abraham was 100. She knew how ridiculous that sounded. Said, should I have pleasure from my Lord in my old age? You know, what are you going to do? Give him vitamin E? What are we going to do here? And she laughed. And God said, who's that laughing in the tent? And Abraham opened up and said, is that you? Sarah laughing, she said, no. Abram said to God, it's not her. God said, yes, it is. It was her. I'm God. I know who laughs. And because she laughed, we're going to name this kid Itzhak, which means laughter. A reminder for the rest of her life that she laughed at one of God's promises. And we'll make that promise live in front of her. Itzhak. Well, somewhere, and I forget, so I won't guess, over 100, Sarah dies. Well, God fixed Abraham. So Abraham, his natural forces are not abated, so at 145 he remarries. And he knew Paul was going to write it's better to marry than to burn, I guess. I don't know, but he remarries at 145 and has more children from Keturah, this woman that he married. Imagine that. And Midian, look there in verse 32, one of her sons is Midian. We know the tribe of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, a Midianite. Sheba and Dedan, that is Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have the same blood flowing in their veins as the Jews. Abraham, their father also. Bringing us to verse 34, this is the story of redemption. And it's going to be interesting to see us so often here, the younger son is chosen over the oldest son. And the birthright was typically given to the oldest son. We're going to see these choices, God superintending this messianic line. Abraham begot Isaac, and the sons of Isaac were Esau and Israel. Now we know that the sons of Isaac were Esau and Jacob, but God's giving us Esau in Israel because it suits his purposes in this line of redemption. Israel's the man that was left after God wrestled with Jacob and put his hip out of joint, and when he limped for the rest of his life, Israel, governed by God. So Esau in Israel. Then it gives us now the sons of Esau. Look there in verse 35. I'm not going to make you read through all of those. There's a handsome list. You should read that on your own. Brings us to Edom, the children of the family of Esau. These are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. So you can read through those. It would be fun for you to read through those kings of Edom there, beginning of verse 43. Brings us down to 51. Hadad also died. Now it lists the dukes of Edom and of Timnah, of Hazard. You see them all there. You can read through those. Stay awake. We'll do something here. Verse 51 down to verse 54, you have those dukes. And these are the sons of Esau. Now we have a theological history again. These are the sons of Israel, or the sons of Jacob, the children of Israel. We hear the children of Israel. Where that name comes from is they're the 12 children of Israel, of Jacob. The children of Israel, the 12 tribes, because they're the offspring of Jacob, of Israel. It gives them to us. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Joseph, Benjamin, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And it begins to give us now the record of those tribes, the sons of Judah, giving us now the messianic line. Beginning in verse 3, it tells us of his sons. Verse 3 says, "And the firstborn of Judah, was evil in the sight of the Lord, and he, the Lord, slew him." Not something that we're necessarily interested in. You don't want that written on your tombstone. "I was evil, so he slew me." But it suits the purposes of the writer, because he's going to be contrasting a nation and a people that are submitted, walking with the Lord and his blessing, versus those who rebel. So there are these things that will put in that suit his purpose. Verse 4 tells us of Tamar, a Gentile woman who ends up in the genealogy of Jesus Christ, you remember, in Matthew chapter 1. The sons of Carmi there in verse 7. Acres, the first one mentioned in your column. You should have a gloss that says Achan, the troubler of Israel, who transgressed in the thing that was accursed. You remember when they came and they took Jericho, when they came into the land. And again, this suits the writer's purposes. God supernaturally, with the blowing of the trumpet, the walls of Jericho fall down, and God, that was the most formidable walls in the land of Canaan. God wanted to use the first victory to be completely his own, to demonstrate to the nation that if they would give themselves to him, that the land would be given to them in their obedience, walking around for 7 days, seven times, the blast of the ram's horn, the walls fall down. God said, "Everything in it belongs to me, burn it, it's holy, it's under the ban, it's dedicated to me." And there was a man named Achan in the tribe, and he fell in love with a Babylonian garment, a wedge of gold and a wedge of silver, took them, buried them in his tent. And they go out to a small battle after that, and they lose miserably. And Joshua says, "Lord, what is it?" And he said, "Well, there's sin in the camp. I'm not going to bless until it's taken care of." Each tribe is brought before Joshua till the tribe of Judah is chosen, and then each of the houses are brought till the house of Achan, and then, you know, finally he's put on the spot, he confesses, he's put to death. He's called here the troubler of Israel because of his disobedience. And again, it suits the writer's purpose. The sons, verse 9, also of Hezron. Now we're coming to the line of David. He wants to get there, that were born unto him Jeremiel, Ram, and Chulubiah. I will go down to verse 11 instead of going through there. Verse 10. Nashon, these should become familiar to you. Salma. Salma begot Boaz, who, remember, married Ruth. And Boaz begat Obed of Ruth. And Obed begat Jesse. Jesse's the father of David. That's where our chronicler is headed. Jesse begot his firstborn, Eliab. And Abinadab, the second. And Shema, the third. Nethaneel, the fourth. Radai, the fifth. Ozem, the sixth. David, the seventh. There's another place where eight brothers are mentioned. One of them must have passed away. David here listed as the seventh. And remember, we hear David, very common name today. When it's listed here, the first David in Scripture is King David. We don't have the name before that in Scripture. So when they first hear David in Israel, it's a very rare name. It set him apart, of course, because of his nature and his character. David's become a very popular name. Verse 16 gives us his sisters. Now, these are half-sisters, same father, different mothers. His sisters were Zariah and Abigail, and the sons of Zariah, Abishai, Joab, and Aziel. We're going to hear much about them. They are David's cousins, or half-cousins, or however that works out there. I don't know. Verse 18 brings us to Caleb, the son of Hezron. And then you can just look along there. Verses 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. You don't want me to read those and do that. I know that is Sunday night. You're going to get up and run out if we start. If you come to verse 50, these were the sons of Caleb, the son of Hur, the firstborn of Ephrathah, which is where Bethlehem comes from. It says that in verse 51. Shalma, the father of Bethlehem. Ephrathah, the house of bread. It gives us the lineage of Caleb, just because he's one who wholly followed the Lord. And then in chapter 3, it brings us now back to David. It jumps, bringing us back. It tells us that he was a Kenite, Caleb, originally a Gentile, who became part of the tribe of Judah. And now the author brings us to chapter 3, where these are the sons of David, which were born to him in Hebron. The firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. The second, Daniel of Abigail, the Carmelitess. The third was Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Gezer. The fourth was Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth was Shaphatiah of Abital. Sounds like something you take when you have a headache. The sixth was Ithream by Eglah, his wife. These six sons... That's trouble. Six sons from six moms. David, man. These six were born... That's a dysfunctional family. That'll never work. These six were born unto him in Hebron. And there he reigned 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years. These were born unto him in Jerusalem. Now added to those six. Now we have Shemaiah, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, that's four, of Bathsheba, which is Bathsheba. This is the only time she's mentioned in Chronicles. The daughter of Amiel. And then it gives us Ibar. Here it says Elishama. It's more properly Elishua. Eliphelet, what a name for a son. Noga, Nepheg, Japhiah, Elishama, Iliada, and Eliphelet. These are nine more born to him. These were all the sons of David besides the sons of concubines and Tamar, their sister. So, David's in for trouble. He's a great king. He's a great psalmist. His family's a mess. And we'll see more of that as we move along. Now we come in verse 10 to Solomon, because our writer is following the Messianic line. And look very quickly, he wants to take us to 16, to Zedekiah. Man, we spent all of that time studying through 1st and 2nd Kings. He's going to get us in a few verses from Solomon to Zedekiah. And he does that because that's when the carrying away to Babylon. He's following this route for the people that would read it. Verse 17, he's going to talk about the sons of Jeconiah. And you can follow that out yourself. It would be good for you. You'll have fun doing that. Chapter 4 to chapter 8 now, he's going to give tribal lines. The sons of Judah, and he gives them in greater detail now because he had come to David. He wanted to point David out. Phares, Hezron, Carmi, you see all of those sons. Follow them down. Of course, verse 9, he takes a break, and it's interesting. Jabez was more honorable than his brethren. His mother called his name Jabez, which means sorrowful, saying, because I bear him in sorrow. Now, how'd you like to have that handle? Hey, sorrowful. You're a sorry looking sight. You can get in here. And Jabez called on the God of Israel, saying, oh, that thou wouldest bless me indeed and enlarge my coast, that thine hand might be with me, that thou wouldest keep me from evil, and that it may not grieve me. And God granted him that which he requested. I mean, it suits the author to take a break and look at this man who was a notable man that we don't really hear much about anywhere else, whose name was Jabez. You know, his name's Jabez, sorrowful. That didn't hold him back. He sought the God of Israel. It says he was more honorable than his brothers. The Hebrew word has the idea of being heavy. He weighed more, no doubt spiritually, than his brethren. This guy was a heavy guy, heavy dude. Prayed, sought the Lord. He called on the God of Israel, and look what he requests. He makes four requests here. Oh, that you would bless me. You know, people think that's a selfish prayer. I don't think it's a selfish prayer. I want God to bless me all the time. He says God answers his prayer here. Look, oh, that you would bless me. Well, that's a good thing to pray, indeed. Enlarge my coast, you know, my borders, bless my possession, my inheritance, what I do, what I give myself to, my ministry, my life. Enlarge my coast, that's a good prayer. That your hand might be with me. I might not try to do anything in my own strength. Lord, let your hand be with me. What a wonderful thing to have the hand of the Lord on our life. Good thing to ask, a wise thing to ask. And look at this. And that you would keep me from evil. Bless me, enlarge my coast, keep your hand on my life, and keep me from evil. That's a wise man. Instead of going out there to do it on his own and defeat the enemy and all of this stuff, Lord, you keep me from evil. Now we know if we pray anything according to his will, we have the petitions that we ask of him. And it says, God granted him that which he requested. It was wonderful in the heart of God that someone would come and say, Lord, I want you to bless me. I want your blessing on my life. Not the blessing of riches, not the blessing of just strictly inheritance, not the blessing of family. Lord, you bless me. My mom didn't. She named me sorrowful. I need somebody to bless me. You bless me. You enlarge, Lord, my coast, my influence, my ministry. Keep your hand upon my life, Lord. These are no doubt sincere pleadings. And keep me from evil, God, that I might not be grieved. And that's what sin and transgression produces in our life, grief. And he's wise enough to know it. The way of the transgressor is hard. That's what the Bible says. And the Lord granted him his request. Interesting. It suited the writer to take his break there because he's writing a theological history and look at this man. Verse 24, we come to Simeon, and it tells us who his sons were. You should read through that. It'll be good for you. You'll enjoy it. Takes a little break in verse 39, speaking of Simeon. It says, they went to the entrance of Gedor, even unto the east side of the valley, to seek pasture for their flocks. They found fat pasture and good, and the land was wide and quiet and peaceable. I like the way that sounds. And they of Ham had dwelt there of old. And these, written by name, came in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and smote their tents. The idea is the inhabitants that were there. And the habitations that were found there, and destroyed them utterly unto this day, and dwelled in their place, in their rooms, because there was pasture there for their flocks. And some of them, even the sons of Simeon, 500 men, went to Mount Seir, having for their captain Pelatiah and Neriah and Rephaiah. I can see why they hung around, all their names sound the same. And Uziel, the sons of Ishi. And they smote the rest of the Amalekites that were escaped and dwelled unto this day. So God takes note there. It suits his purpose that these men destroy the remainder of the Amalekites who God had put a curse on, that they were fulfilling God's will. The sons of Reuben, look in chapter 5, the firstborn of Israel, the oldest son of Jacob. For he was the firstborn, but for as much as he defiled his father's bed, he went into his father's concubine, remember that. His birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, the son of Israel, and the genealogy not to be reckoned after the birthright. Then the genealogy wasn't reckoned after Reuben. For Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler. But the birthright was with Joseph. Now, Joseph received the double portion because Joseph's sons were Manasseh and Ephraim. Two sons, he received the double portion. But the blessing in the Messianic line followed Judah. The writer's purpose is immorality. There was a defiling. God's blessing was removed from a life that deliberately defiled and crosses a line in sin. A transgression that's done deliberately, and particularly one where the conscience ahead of time knows, no, this line should not be stepped across. Suits the writer's purposes. The sons of Reuben, verse 18. And the Gadites and half the tribe of Manasseh, valiant men, able to bear buckler and sword and shoot with the bow, skillful in war, were 44,760. They went out to war. They made war with the Hagarites and with Jetur, and Nephish, Nodab, and they were helped against them. And the Hagarites were delivered into their hand, and all that were with them. And they cried unto God in battle, and he was entreated of them, because they put their trust in him. Now this is suiting the writer's purpose. Again, he's pointing to the fact that they cried unto God. They trusted in the Lord, and that the God then granted them victory in battle, because they trusted in him. They took away the cattle and the camels, so forth. It tells us about their spoil. And there fell down many slain, because of the war was of God, and they dwelt in their stead in their captivity. It just tells us there now about this great victory, and it was victorious because they trusted in the Lord. Verse 23 tells us of the children of the half tribe of Manasseh. Verse 25 says this, and it suits the writer's purpose. They transgressed against the God of their fathers. They went a-whoring after other gods of the people of the land whom God had destroyed before them. And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away, even the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them to Halah, and Habor, and Hara, to the river of Gozan, north of Damascus, unto this day. So his purpose, they sinned against the Lord. It's interesting, when we look at them coming to the border of the land. Reuben, Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh, after 40 years in the wilderness, when they're getting ready to cross the Jordan River, say to Moses, the pasture land here is good, this area of Gilead. We don't have any desire to go over. And it almost started a war. And they said, no, our intention is not to rip off the rest of the nation. And Moses said, okay, you can have this area on the other side of Jordan, Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. You can stay here, but we'll take these cities now. You put your wives, you put your little ones, your cattle, but you go with the army of Israel, and you fight the battles of Canaan for 7 years, and you're not allowed to come home to your families until all of your brethren also receive their inheritance. And there comes the challenge, be sure that your sin will find you out, if not. And it's a picture of those who settle for less. God's ideal for them all of those years in the wilderness journey was to cross the Jordan and enter into Canaan. In that land, where Bethlehem was, where the Messiah would be born, where Jerusalem was, that would be the city of the great king, where David would reign, in that land. And they settled for less. Well, it was good pasture. It's good for their cows. But spiritually, it was less than what God had for them. And what it tells us is when the land began to come under the pressure of the Assyrians and so forth, they were the first to be carried away. And, you know, I look at that and I think, look, what God's best is for us, you have to understand this. We're in a warfare. There's going to be battle. We struggle in our thoughts, with our thoughts, with difficulties. I think it takes us years to realize that what changes is us, not the circumstances. We're in a world where there's suffering and difficulty and injustice. But in all of those things, what God wants to change is that which is within us. We're going to have battle either way. If you're going to have a battle and you're going to have a struggle, you want to be where God is. If you're going to be in a battle anyway, you want to see the walls of Jericho fall down. If you're going to be in a battle anyway, you want to see the sun and the moon stand still in the valley of Ajalon and God destroy the enemy, raining down hail from heaven. If you're going to be in battle anyway, you want to be where you can stand back and watch the hand of the Lord and be awestruck at the God we serve. You don't want to settle for less. And these years later, Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, the furthest from Jerusalem, the furthest away from God's purpose, and they lived at a distance. They're the first ones to compromise, to go after other gods, and they're the first to be carried away. And it suits the writer's purpose to tell us that. He brings us to chapter 6 and begins now to give us the history of the tribe of Levi, ones that come to Levi and to Aaron, to the temple. Israel alone among the nations of the world has no destiny except in its service of the Lord. Israel alone amongst the nations of the world has no destiny except in its service of the Lord. God will ultimately come. The Lord will come and set up his throne there in Jerusalem. It says Israel will serve him. That is their purpose. to be the servant of the Lord amongst the nations of the world. You and I will reign with him, it says. Israel. Set aside. He begins with the tribe of Levi, of course, and traces out the sons of Levi. Very important, these people that were carried away into captivity, when they're brought back through Ezra and Nehemiah, need to be able to trace their lineage, because if you want to be a priest or a Levite, you have to have Levi genes, and you wouldn't know that unless you had this table to, what? Unless you had this table to trace that, okay? That's what this is about, Levi genes. So the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, Merari, the sons of Kohath. Now the Kohath are the Kohens today, the Kohanim. They trace their family to one of the sons of Levi, which was Cohen, Kohath. The children of Amram, Aaron and Moses and Miriam. He goes there quickly in this family because, of course, any Jew wants to immediately be brought to Moses and to Aaron and Miriam. Isn't it interesting? We don't know what Moses' name was. Moses means to draw out. It was the name given to him by Pharaoh's daughter. We never found out what his Hebrew name was. We just know his Egyptian name, Moses. I wonder what his real name was. Verse 4, Eleazar, Phinehas, you know these names, Abishua, the sons of Levi. Over in 16, goes through more, again, the sons of Lehi, Gershom, Kohath, Merari, traces them out. And we know from Numbers they all had distinct responsibilities. Interesting to look over in verse 31, talking about the sons of Merari again, and it says, these are they whom David, so all the way into the days of David, their lineage had been preserved so they could prove the right to serve in the temple as Levites. Very important. These are they whom David set over the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark had rest. In other words, it had to be in your family. You know what I mean? You didn't come and audition at the tabernacle or the temple to see if you're a good player. Oh, this guy's a dynamite drummer. We got to get him in the band. No, you had to have it in your gene pool. You had to be, it was passed down to the son and the family. The sons of Merari, they're named here, become the singers. Traced all the way back to Aaron and to Levi, still identifiable in the days of David. David sets them over the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark had rest. They ministered before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of the congregation with singing until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. And they waited on their office according to their order. These are they that waited on the children of Israel. It's interesting down there in verse 33. He-Man, you thought he was a guy on television. It says here he was a singer. You thought he was much more masculine. Then he was a singer. It tells us there in verse 33. Taking us to verse 49, Aaron and his sons offered upon the altar of burnt offering and on the altar of incense and were appointed for all the work of the place most holy and to make an atonement for Israel by sacrifice according to all that Moses, the servant of God, had commanded. These are the sons of Aaron, Eleazar, Phinehas, Abishua. Again, we know their names. So Aaron's line distinct among the tribe of Levi. Aaron and his lineage distinctly set aside to be priests. The others of Levi are the Levites. They would serve in the tabernacle in the temple, but the priestly line alone was the one that would offer the lambs that would go in, particularly on the day Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. It was the high priest that went behind the veil. You couldn't just be a Levite. You had to be of Aaron's line to do that. So very important, because again, these people coming back from Babylon are not going to have a king, but they are going to rebuild the temple, and there is going to be worship. So it's very important they be able to trace these things to the Levites and the priests. Now it gives us again all of their names. I'm not going to read that. It gives us all of the suburbs, the neighborhoods they lived in. Brings us to chapter 7. You didn't think we could move like this, did you? Chapter 7 gives us now the sons of Issachar. You want to read them? You can. I think you'll enjoy it. It'll be good for you. Down verse 6, we have the sons of Benjamin. I did this last time. Here's a sampling of what you're missing. The sons of Benjamin, Bela, Beaker, the head of the Muppet tribe, Jediel, those were three. The sons of Bela, Ezbon, Uzi, Uziel. You wouldn't want two Uzi, so you got a Uzi and a Uziel. Jeremoth, Eri. I think I had one of those. It was a little eerie. The heads of the house of their fathers, mighty men of valor, and were reckoned by their genealogies, 22,034. The sons of Beker. You didn't even know he was married, did you? Zimara, Joash, Eliezer, Ilionaiah, Omri, Jeremoth, Abiai, Anathoth. Say that again. Anathoth, Iameth. You know, I think back then there weren't names, so they just made them up. All these are sons of Beker. The number of them, after their genealogy, by their generation, heads of the house of their fathers, mighty men of valor, there are 20,200. The sons of Jediliah, Bilan. The sons of Bilan were Jeush and Benjamin. I recognize that. Ehud, Chena, Anna, sure. Zethan, Tarshish, Ashahar. All these, the sons of Jadiel, by the heads of their fathers, mighty men of valor, there were 17,200 soldiers fit to go out to war and to battle. And Shippim, somewhere, also, and Huppim, Shippim and Huppim. Now, who would do that? Who would do that to your kids? I don't understand. Shippim and Huppim. Sounds like something happens at the dock, doesn't it? The children of Ir. And Husham, the sons of Ayer. I like 13. This is the easy. I wish all the tribes were this short. The sons of Naphtali, Jaziel and Guni, and Jezer, Shalom, the sons of Bila. That was interesting. That was fast. Now we're already to Manasseh. It gives the names of the tribes of Manasseh. See, there's no sense us doing that. Because I'm not saying them all right. Even if I do, you don't know, so you don't appreciate it when I get one right. Very important to the post-exile tribes, no doubt, because they could look and find their family in here. They find the suburbs they lived in. Some they find where some of their inheritance was. Very important for them to have these records. The sons of Manasseh, beginning in verse 14, it gives their names. I see the daughters there. Zelophehad. Yeah. Zelophehad and his daughters are there, mentioned in verse 15. That's a great story in Numbers. Verse 20, the sons of Ephraim, and it lists them out in front of us there. Ephraim brings us to Nun, verse 27, his son Jehoshua. That's Joshua, the son of Nun, as it says in Numbers. His name was Hosea, which means salvation. Moses changed his name to Yahoshia. The Lord has become salvation. First book in the Bible named after a person, Joshua. Isn't that fitting? The name of our Savior. The first five books, the law. Moses, the giver of the law, unable to bring people into God's promises because the law can never do that. Who's the one then who brings them across the river? Joshua. Jesus, the one who brings God's people into the promises of God, and brings us to Joshua here. Goes over their possessions, verse 30, the sons of Asher. Chapter 8, verse 1, Benjamin, his sons. Specifically going to Benjamin because he wants to get to Saul, the first king of Israel, so that he can move us along to David. Remember, Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin, his father's house, a Gibeonite of the city of Gibeah. So now Benjamin begot Bela, the firstborn. You can read through those. You see those names again. We're not going to do that. There's a lot of them. Brings us to verse 29. And that's where he's headed. And at Gibeon dwelt the father of Gibeon, whose wife's name was Maacah, his firstborn son, Abdon, and Zur and Kish. Notice. And Baal. Now, isn't that, don't you have nerve being a Gibeonite living in Israel and naming your son Baal? Man. Nadab, Geder. When he gets to Kish and to Gibeon there, verse 29, he's got us to Saul's tribe, Saul's family. Saul was a Gibeonite. And he takes us through the line of Saul. Down, ends down in verse 40, these are all the sons of Benjamin. So all Israel was reckoned. Imagine that. We reckoned all of Israel in 50 minutes. Now, God's knowledge of us, by the way, is complete also. Well, you know, we read through these genealogies, and again, I'm sure there's beauty if we would have the time to tear apart every name and every phrase to look at what's happening there. Part of the beauty of it all is God knows the name of every father, every son, every mother. He knows their dwelling. He knew when they were by a river, by Gibeon, by a certain place. We read through that, but some... where speaking above that is the voice of God saying, I know your family, I know your father, I know your children by name, I know where you live, I know your lineage, I know your gifts, I know your inheritance, I know who you are, I know where you live in relationship to me and in relationship to spiritual things. I know what will happen to your life if you obey and yield to me and give yourself to me, the blessing that will come. I know what will happen to a life that turns away, that needs chastening and rebuke. And of all of those names that we passed over, not a single one of them is unimportant to God, because every one of them has a story. Every one of them has a pulse. Every one of them has a heart and a mind. Every one of them has a purpose. Every one of them is part of a 3,500-year history that links the post-exiled people with this tremendous legacy they have in the nation of Israel, back to David and to Abraham, to Noah, to Adam. Chapter 9, verses 1 to 34, specifically now outlining citizens of Jerusalem. So all Israel was reckoned by genealogies. Behold, they're written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah, who were carried away to Babylon for their transgression. And it gives us the names of these that lived in Jerusalem. Verse 10 to 13 lists the priests that were dwelling in Jerusalem. Jedidiah, Jehoiarib, Jachin. You can read through the names of these priests. You will probably recognize some of them. Verse 14, the Levites that lived in Jerusalem. Shemaiah, Hashab. You read through these names. Look at verse 15. Look at that name. Bakbakar. Who's going to name their kid Bakbakar? Sounds like something a parrot says, doesn't it? Bakbakar, or a chicken or something. 17, the porters. These are the gatekeepers and others that had specific duties that lived in Jerusalem, that waited on the king's gate on the east and their companies, and it gives the different gates that God knows who's keeping the gates, who keeps the doors. I wish I can convince everybody that had a key to this building that God knows who they are and when they leave things unlocked, and that he appreciates those who are a good steward over the things that he paid for in the blood of his son. Verse 22, all these which were chosen to be porters in the gates were 212. These were reckoned by their genealogy in their villages, whom David and Samuel the seer did ordain in their set office. So they and their children had the oversight of the gates of the house of the Lord, namely the house of the tabernacle, and inwards. You know, I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of the Lord than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. We have the psalmist saying, oh, how amiable are thy courts, O Lord. How I long to come. Traveling through the valley of Baca, going through sorrow, making that journey, longing to see your tabernacles, to be in your presence. How remarkable. What a privilege. to be a gatekeeper in the house of the Lord, to serve. Look in verse 33. This is beautiful. Outline again. And these are the singers, chief of the fathers of the Levites, who, remaining in the chambers, were free, for they were employed in that work day and night. 24 hours a day, there were those that were singing in the tabernacle precincts and in the temple of Solomon. Any hour of the day, a worshiper could go there and hear someone from the tribe of Levi lifting up sacred songs and psalms. An amazing 24 hours a day. 24 hours a day, anytime, heartbroken. You could walk into the courts of the tabernacle or the temple when it was built, and there were those who had the specific duty, not 24-hour prayer, 24-hour worship going on. So someone could come and sit and settle their heart before the Lord, listen to the sacred psalms of David, the psalmist, the writers that had written psalms, Moses had written psalms, and so many, Asaph, his name's listed in here. Remarkable. I had the privilege one time of sitting by the Wailing Wall at about 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning, maybe 2 o'clock, Bill Galton and I. It was the limestone seats there were still hot from the sun all day. It was cool, but the stone was warm, and we just sat there. They have a tradition, of course, at the Wailing Wall that you never leave the wall unattended, so there would be a Jew praying at the wall. And when we first got there were a number, but slowly they slipped away. I left one guy there. He couldn't leave. He's the last guy, so he's praying at the wall. And then when somebody else comes up to pray and touches the wall, he gets away real fast before, that guy looks, hey, he got away on me. So then he has to stay. It's a tradition. And we just sat there, watched this whole thing. And this cat was there playing with this praying mantis. And he'd roll on his back and hit it up in the air. When there was a number of Jews worshiping there, they'd come up, yell at him and kick at him. And the cat would run away and they'd go back to the wall. And then the cat would walk back out in the middle of this big open court again and roll on his back and start throwing it. And they'd run. I think he was teasing them. I don't know. We just sat there, and I could just sense the presence of my father. The limestone was warm, and I could see the moon and the stars above the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. And I thought, here's Israel blinded in part till the fullness of the Gentiles come in and worshiping and this tradition and almost being stuck to the wall, not wanting to be there, and how I could just sit there and sense the presence of God, the presence of my Father, and the warmth from His presence and His love, I had been some lunatic hippie taking drugs and on my way to hell, and He saved me and chastened me and shaped me up and drugged me all the way across the Lord, just all the way across the world to sit me there. And I thought, how wonderful, it must have been in those days to come anytime, 2 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, and have some of the sacred Levites there with instruments and singers and listen to the sacred songs being offered to the Lord 24 hours a day. Heaven's going to be better. They were going to sing and play in stringed instruments in the house of the Lord forever. That'll really be something. I'm looking forward to that. Verse 35 says, and in Gibeon dwelt the father of Gibeon, Jaleel, whose wife's name was Maacah. We already had read that, but we've come now to Saul's genealogy. His firstborn son was Abdon and Zur and Kish and Baal, Ner, Nadab, and Gader, and Ahio, Zechariah, Mikloth. We'll go down the names here. Verse 39, Ner begot Kish, and Kish begot Saul. Saul begot Jonathan, and Malchishua, Abinadab, Eshbaal. The son of Jonathan was Meribel. Meribel begot Micah. Sons of Micah, Python, Melech, Teriah, Ahaz. And Ahaz begot Jehara. Jehara begot Aleth, Asmaveth, Zimri, Moza. Moza begot Beniah. Raphiah, his son, Elisha, his son, Azel, his son. Azel had six sons, but you didn't know that. Azrakam, Bokru, Ishmael, Sariah, Obadiah, Hannah. These were the sons of Azael. We've come to the family of Saul. That's where the Lord is taking us. Next week, when we begin, we will begin fresh here in chapter 10 with the story of Saul and his death, slaughtered by the Philistines, taken to Bashan. And then look in verse 1 of chapter 11, it says, "Then all Israel gathered themselves to David, to Hebron." So, in one night we covered from Genesis chapter 1 to 2 Samuel chapter 3. One night. I'm proud of you guys. It was a journey. The purpose of this writer, Ezra, to trace these things so quickly, to bring us into Israel's royal line, the King David, because the messianic promise will be made to him and to his house, then to the things of the Levites, the priests, and the temple itself, because those who will return from Babylon with Ezra will come to rebuild that temple. And many of these things will be necessary of this record. So I encourage you, read ahead.